Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Page one story in the New York Times this week. Senior U.S. commanders in Afghanistan are pushing hard to take the ground war with U.S. forces into Pakistan. Everybody denies it, but that is one hot trial balloon. What would that mean? And on the peace front, we'll hear from Pulitzer Prize winner Chris Hedges, arrested last week at the White House gates, who is calling for a wave of activism to stop the war. This hour on Point, we're looking at war and peace and the choices being made. You can join the conversation. Is it clear-eyed or crazy to send U.S. troops into Pakistan to go after Taliban safe havens? And what about peace? You can comment at our website as well, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will talk with Chris Hedges, who, along with more than 100 other peace protesters, was arrested last week in front of the White House. But first, to Pakistan's safe havens and U.S. intentions. Joining us from the Pakistani capital of Lahore is Ahmed Rashid, Pakistani journalist and author, renowned expert on the Taliban and security issues in that region, author of Descent into Chaos. Ahmed Rashid, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
We'll look at the Times report and the denials, but just remind us first of why U.S. commanders might want to actually go with U.S. troops, special forces, into Pakistan. If they did that, we'll talk about that, but what would they be going after, Ahmed?
Well, from the U.S. side, there is enormous frustration that most of the Taliban leadership is still living in Pakistan, and the Taliban have been using Pakistan to rearm, to get more recruits, and all three network leaders, that is the main Taliban from the 1990s, which is called the Quetta Shura, Jalaluddin Haqqani's group, which is called the Haqqani Network, and Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, they're all living alongside the Pakistan border inside Pakistan. And there is enormous pressure that the U.S. surge being undertaken by General Petraeus cannot succeed until these safe havens are taken out or these Taliban are controlled, something that the Pakistani authorities have really not been willing to do, although they have gone after the Pakistani Taliban, who are threatening the Pakistan state. But they have not gone after the Afghan Taliban.
Ahmed Rashid, how do the safe havens in Pakistan undermine, if that's what happens, how do they undermine the U.S. push inside Afghanistan? How does it work exactly? The Taliban leaders are there, but on the ground, how does it undercut American military efforts in the surge?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, the history of the last century shows us that no insurgency has ever been successful without a safe haven somewhere. And of course, Vietnam is the biggest example, with the South Vietnamese having North Vietnam as a safe haven. And the fact is that when you have a safe haven, the fact is that you can cross back into Pakistan, you can rest, you can get medical treatment, you can rearm, you can get resupplied with food and ammunition and money, and of course get recruits, because there's still some 3 million Afghan refugees living in Pakistan, and these refugee camps remain hotbeds of recruitment. Plus, of course, there are now increasingly large numbers of Pakistani extremists who are fighting alongside the Afghan Taliban inside Afghanistan, and they can be easily recruited. And there are Central Asians and a mishmash of Arabs, Central Asians, people working with Al-Qaeda, which is also partly based in Pakistan. So there's no shortage of fighters, and the more Taliban that General Petraeus wants to kill, it's a losing proposition, because simply, you know, there are more Taliban being created from the Pakistan side of the border, and it must be said, on the Afghan side of the border.
There are a lot of denials now from NATO, from the White House, from a Pentagon spokesman, and more, saying, no, we don't want to go into Pakistan. But do you think General Petraeus has been pushing for something like this, U.S. Special Forces, U.S. troops, on the ground across the border in Pakistan to go after these safe havens?
Well, I think, you know, Petraeus has got a lot at stake here. I mean, he's staking his reputation, basically, on making this surge a success. And I was in Kabul a few weeks ago, and, you know, U.S. officials were openly saying that they cannot succeed in this surge as long as the safe haven remains. General Petraeus has generally been much more aggressive than previous NATO-American commanders in Afghanistan. And he's normally had he's got his way with the White House. We saw the increase in American troops. We saw just a week ago this review that was carried out by President Obama, which kind of reinforced the Petraeus push. But I don't believe that the Americans will actually put boots on the ground inside Pakistan. I think that could trigger off such an enormous repercussion from the Pakistani side. I mean, the government may fall, the extremists would be hugely bolstered, there could be an unrest in the Pakistan army because of this, because there's so much anti-Americanism both in the public and in the army. I think this would be a hugely politically risky venture if something like this happened. Now, that is not to say that relations are going to get any better, because relations between the two countries are very bad. You know, despite the papering over, saying, like Obama did last week, saying, you know, Pakistan can do more, but actually things are fine. In fact, you know, in the last few days, we've seen the outing of the CIA station chief in Islamabad. He's had to go home because his name was mentioned in public, and he was given death threats by several Pakistanis, and his name has been in the media here. There have been a continuous kind of stream of burning of NATO's fuel tankers and supply trucks that bring supplies up from Karachi into Afghanistan for U.S. forces. So there have been, you know, numerous incidents which have kept the pot boiling. And what I think is needed right now, given the winter months, is some kind of better understanding between the two countries.
So you see a possible real mayhem if U.S. forces went in. There are denials all around, but here was this page one story from senior commanders saying they feel like they're closer than ever to getting the green light to do it. It's a big, incredible step if it should ever happen. Ahmed Rashid describing there the possibility of the Pakistani government falling, militants bolstered, a split possibly in the Pakistani defense forces over it. Nevertheless, even if just as a trial balloon, it is now on the table or in the air. Ahmed Rashid, please stand by in Lahore. Daniel Gouray joins us from Washington, vice president there with the Lexington Institute. He's worked at the Pentagon during the first Bush administration. Daniel Gouray, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
You are in that group in Washington that says, well, I assume that this wouldn't necessarily be pretty, but should be done. Why?
Well, as Mr. Rashid said perfectly, there is no way to achieve a successful outcome, whether it's victory or some kind of stability or even hold the line in Afghanistan while there are these safe havens across the border. In addition, we now know, partly from the Times Square bomber, that there is training going on for potential terrorists by al-Qaeda in these safe havens. As a result, you know, there is an increasing kind of interest in doing something to disrupt these havens, to see if one can disrupt the training process, can possibly even capture or kill very high-ranking Taliban or al-Qaeda personnel.
We've seen denials all over the place since the New York Times put this story very prominently on page one, lead story. Do you think it's a ridiculous idea that could happen, or is there a serious push within the military in Washington for this kind of move?
I think there's actually been various pushes along for this kind of operation for a fairly long time. You know, the Special Forces has been doing, if you will, training missions in Pakistan. We know we've been running all the various overt and covert reconnaissance operations, as well as actual strike missions in Pakistan, CIA run or special operations or whatever. So we've been, you know, ratcheting up, if you will, the pressure and the level of violence that we've been inflicting within Pakistan in order to do some level of disruption. It turns out it's not enough. That's clear by all the analyses by the recent strategic review. As a result, the military certainly would like to have the option. I mean, if one actually could find bin Laden, but had to be, you prefer to take him out or to capture him with a ground operation, the military would like to at least have that option discussed, not have it come as a total surprise to the U.S. national leadership if it were to be something that were opportune.
There will be a lot of people pushing against this, but you've said that Barack Obama might do it, that he wouldn't want the rest of this term, when he's looking for a second term, to be marred by the equivalent of the fall of Saigon, which you see a potential risk here, Kabul going down as he's campaigning for the presidency. Do you think the president would really give a green light to this? The White House is saying no.
The White House will probably say no up till the minute that it orders or gives a go-ahead for the operation. It's quite clear, and Mr. Rashid said this, you cannot win this war. You probably cannot even achieve the minimum goals of really disrupting and degrading the Taliban and even creating the space to stabilize the situation in Afghanistan while you allow all these safe havens to operate. The other thing, of course, is that to the extent that this becomes a threat to the Taliban, to al-Qaeda, it may in fact be minimally useful just by forcing them to move around more, to watch their backs more, to keep an eye open for things that are going on. It may force them out of self-protection to shut down some of the training camps and training sites that are operating in Pakistan. And that all may be for the good, even if the attacks really never come.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about war and peace, about the reported push to send the U.S. military into Pakistan after militant safe havens there, and later this hour with peace activist Chris Hedges, who says, no, bring it all home, stop the war. He and more than 100 others were arrested at the front gates of the White House last week. He will join us. Daniel Garay joins us from the Lexington Institute in Washington, think tank there. Ahmed Rashid is in Lahore, Pakistan, author of Descent into Chaos. Ahmed, if they did it, I mean, you're describing a list of sort of horribles that might follow: a fall of the Pakistan government, militants bolstered, split in the Pakistan military, perhaps. With all that, why would you, if that's clear, why would U.S. commanders, some of them anyway, be quoted pushing for this, Ahmed?
Well, I think, some U.S. commanders may be thinking that a short incursion into Pakistan to capture specific members of the Taliban or kill them would not necessarily trigger off a huge crisis in Pakistan. I think this is a trial balloon, and I think one reaction from this can be that in the next couple of weeks we might see some action by the Pakistan Army. If not action on the ground, because it's winter now, it's incredibly cold up there in this border region and the tribal belt of North Waziristan, you may see air action by the Pakistanis quite soon. And if the Americans are going to provide specific intelligence to the Pakistanis and the Pakistanis express a willingness to do something, I think we may see some air action as a way of cooling down this ongoing pressure right now that Pakistan faces. The other thing I just want to comment is that, the fact is, we know from Bob Woodward's book how the debate between the Pentagon and the civilian leadership in the state, the White House, the NSC, the State Department, etc., how tense it has been both last year and even this year. The Pentagon has certainly been pushing for a much stronger military response vis-a-vis al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And Obama's instincts and his aides and people around him have been more geared towards trying to pull out, trying to withdraw U.S. forces rather than commit more and more U.S. forces. And I think what we're seeing with this trial balloon is more of this, I think, internal tension inside Washington.
Daniel Garay, you had a slip of the tongue before the break there, Christmas Day bombing, which will take a lot of listeners back to 1972, the Vietnam War. And, of course, online, we have a lot of listeners saying Cambodia, Cambodia, reminding us of how the U.S. went in there during the Vietnam War. And they ended up with Pol Pot, the Khmer Rouge, and all the rest. I mean, you're for this, but what about the possibility of a real regional meltdown? I mean, Pakistan just cracking up over the presence. You saw what happened when the U.S. helicopters just fired into Pakistan, killed a couple of Pakistani soldiers. They shut down the Khyber Pass. How many dozens of big fuel tankers were burned after that, and demonstrations around the country? If this happened and was public, you know, what about the risk of Pakistan, never mind whether it's a good idea or not, but Pakistan going up in flames?
Well, that would clearly be something that would have to be factored in. And as a result, you would have to assume that if the military wants to do this, either they have some kind of reassurances on the Pakistani side, particularly from the Pakistani military. You know, if you do it once, it's okay, but not twice, something of that sort. Or the target has to be so juicy, so interesting, so valuable. As I said, bin Laden himself, if he thought this was going to happen, that it's sort of worth the risk, or it would be argued by the military that it's worth the risk. The other thing is, this may be a case where you're not talking about a campaign. We're not talking about huge forces. We're not talking about sending a division across the border and having it, clear, hold, and build, as the expression goes, but rather an in-and-out operation. And one might argue that one successful operation, if I was the military, I would certainly make the argument, one successful operation of this kind would not only give you great benefits in terms of what you get immediately from whoever you capture or kill, but in addition would put all the other organizations, the other two of the three networks, assuming you only go after one at the moment, that they have to operate differently, they have to pull back, they have to pull in, they cannot simply lead the comfortable life, if you will. That itself might be very useful. The last point here is it does suggest, as the military is sort of, to the extent the military has been brooding these ideas around for quite a while, that the actual military situation in Afghanistan is not as good as the strategic review we just had would have us believe.
And part of the reason for that, what, being the safe havens across the border, they're not going to keep up this face of some kind of quieter period if those are still there?
Well, quieter period being, of course, over the winter, it tends to be rather quiet. But what they're really suggesting, you're not going to conduct major operations across those mountains in the winter anyway. This is a setup for what you might do starting in the late spring when the season, if you will, opens up. It does suggest that we've done the best we could with the 30,000 surge. We've seen what we can do in terms of immediately training Afghan forces and the limits of that, the limits of setting up good governance in the South and all the rest, and it ain't enough. That's the real point. And therefore, the idea of going across the border in conjunction with all these things may look much more attractive to the military planners.
It's kind of mind-blowing. We're talking war at the moment. We'll be talking peace in just a minute with Chris Hedges. Let's go to our listeners, Buffalo, New York, Marissa. Marissa, you're on the air.
Hello.
What do you think, Marissa?
I feel that it's ridiculous for our government, for our military, to assume that we can overextend ourselves to yet another country, a third country at this point, when we have so many conflicts going on within our own country that we can't handle financially. Even with our returning soldiers, just to think that we would send them to yet another place that we can't even have a reassurance that this issue would be solved.
$190 million a day on the Afghan war, and you say that's enough, no further, please. Marissa, we've got it. Let me get one more. Lotta, South Carolina. Edward, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I'm wondering why you sound so alarmed at all this. We still have Barack Obama's address to the Woodrow Wilson Center in August of 2001, where he claimed at the time, plainly for everybody to hear, if we have actionable intelligence about high-value terrorist targets in Pakistan, he said, I will not hesitate to use military force to take out terrorists who pose a direct threat to America. That's been on the table since August of 2007.
I mean, you're quite right about that, Edward. No question. And again, in the presidential campaign, Barack Obama saying, you know, he'd be prepared to order U.S. troops into Pakistan unilaterally if it failed to act on its own against Islamic extremists. Ahmed Rashid, where do you see Barack Obama in this? He was very plain, as Edward says, in his campaign and earlier, that he would go into Pakistan. But he's, of course, had a learning curve since then, or not?
Well, you know, I think his policy towards Pakistan has been very nuanced and very careful. He's also been extremely generous. American aid is coming to Pakistan, both to the military and to civil society, in
in very large quantities. I think, you know, the whole problem is that Obama inherited this whole issue of safe havens from the Bush administration. Bush over two terms had done nothing about it, and there was no Pakistan strategy either to help the country improve itself or to deal more roughly with these safe havens. And he inherited this problem. I really don't think he expected when he came into power and he took office, I don't think he expected that such that the situation was so bad. The problem with Pakistan is not only that the military may be unwilling to go after the Afghan Taliban for many reasons. The fact is that the country remains very weak and vulnerable. Just like in Afghanistan, there's a very weak government, a very weak leadership, which is controlled very strongly by the military. The government itself has very little independent foreign policy decision-making capabilities, a very bad economy, which is, you know, making a lot of people jobless and unhappy and even more extreme in their views. So we're not just dealing with a normal country. We're dealing with a country that is already at a tipping point, perhaps.
Ahmed, Daniel Garay says that if you're looking for reasons that the president might do this, President Obama, he said he could be facing a kind of fall of Saigon scenario in Kabul in the balance of this term, as he's campaigning for another term as president. That kind of, you know, collapse in Afghanistan might prompt this across-the-border look. What do you think of that? Are those the stakes? We had this sort of soothing strategic review just a couple of weeks ago. But, you know, could they be looking privately at the collapse of the whole effort in Afghanistan?
No, I don't think so. Certainly not. The Taliban are in no position to take any major city in Afghanistan, and certainly not Kabul. They can continue to harass and kill U.S. forces, but they, you know, they certainly cannot take major cities. And the NATO-U.S. strength and air power, et cetera, will prevent that. Many Pakistanis are saying that, you know, the Americans have failed in Afghanistan, and now they're using this issue of safe havens as a kind of scapegoat. But the fact is that, you know, in Afghanistan, things are not going well. There's a very weak government. President Karzai has been under a cloud of all sorts of things, from corruption to incompetence to taking bad decisions. There's a constant fight there between Karzai and the U.S. leadership in Kabul, which General Petraeus, with the U.S. ambassador and with others. And the fact is that the Taliban, you know, despite this pressure that they're facing in the south of the country, have been making gains in other parts of the country, particularly in the north and the west. And certainly I think the only way that what is dramatically needed, I think, by the U.S. is to open up some kind of dialogue negotiations with the Taliban. This is what Karzai has been trying to urge the Americans to do. This is what the Pakistanis have been urging the Americans to do, that what is needed is some kind of settlement. And there are indications, and certainly I've had those indications, that perhaps some elements of the Taliban, not all of them, some elements of the old Taliban, the generation that ran the movement in the early 1990s, are ready for talks, but they want to talk to the Americans. And that's something that is not happening right now.
Daniel Garay, I'll bring that to you. A couple of callers first. Rob in Richmond, Kentucky. Rob, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. I think we ought to support our general, and I think we should work with the Pakistani military forces as close as possible. We have to take the fight to the enemy.
But would you put U.S. troops, U.S. special forces, you know, in Pakistan when Pakistan says, no, we do not want that, it's sovereign, do not bring them here, would you do it anyway?
Well, the thing is that their security forces, their special forces, they have to understand that terrorism has to be stopped. We have to take the fight to the enemy. And, you know, it'd be nice to talk, but a lot of folks don't understand talking. You have to go in and fight and kill the enemy.
Rob, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here. New Haven, Connecticut. Elizabeth, you're on the air, Elizabeth.
Okay. I have the opposite view. I think that the Taliban is fueled by our belligerence. I think the belligerent response has always been the absolute wrong way to handle this. That the Al-Qaeda was created from all of the horrible, policies against Iraq and providing impossible situations for children, you know, to receive medication and food and all this stuff. And
so if President Obama is thinking about going into Pakistan, if he's thinking about it, what would you say to him, Elizabeth?
It's going to go harder if they go into Pakistan. It's just going to create a... it's just going to pour more gas on the fire and be impossible.
Elizabeth, I appreciate your call. I mean, again, this is a reported push for this. There are denials all over, but the conversation really concentrates the mind. Daniel Garay, what about it? Ahmed Rashid says, negotiate. Get a settlement here rather than expanding the field of conflict.
And if you really love the Israeli-Palestinian negotiating process, you will have a wonderful time with this one. I mean, the idea, I don't dispute it, but the idea that one can come up with a solution, particularly when you're only negotiating with a fraction of a faction of the groups, while go for it, is unlikely to provide the kind of solution one needs in the time available. Remember, we're not talking about an open-ended situation here. The president wants to begin withdrawal of these extra forces by next summer. We've had one campaigning season, really, with these forces, not all of them. We'll have half of another one, and then the withdrawals begin to be completed by 2014. Given the kind of situation, as Mr. Rashid even in fact suggested, which is it may be winning in the South, but you're losing in the North and West, it's hard to believe that the current situation, the current approach, is going to be successful, certainly in the time available. Therefore, in addition to negotiating, in addition to working with the Pakistanis, in addition to bolstering the Afghan government, it seems reasonable for the military to at least look at how one can change the situation on the ground, the military situation. And one aspect of that, maybe the only new thing they can do now, is in fact to take some of the fight across the border.
Drone attacks aren't enough. And how do you keep this from becoming a bigger hornet's nest if you do that? You know how explosive this would be in Pakistan.
Well, I mean, what's interesting here is how explosive would it be versus might it be? There's a lot of theory here. We're doing amazing things across the border, not only the supply routes going in, the special forces operations. We were operating from Pakistani territory back in 2001, which is something that most of the experts, not all, would have told us and did tell us was absolutely impossible. The drone strikes under this administration have gone up several fold, if not many fold, and have had relatively small responses compared to what people would have suggested. It may be that this is a trial balloon, but in fact, part of the reason for the trial balloon is to see what kind of response it brings in Pakistan and whether or not there is at least some elements in that government or in that the political hierarchy there who would be willing to support that on some kind of an interim limited basis. And you know, whether the response might not be as bad as the worst case that Mr. Rashid suggested.
So you're thinking maybe this will really happen? Maybe it's not just a trial balloon? Could you see Barack Obama signing off on this, despite, you know, the kind of protest? And you've got people, Richard Haass and Maughan, saying, yep, just get out of there.
Look, he is between Kabul and a real hard place here. It has been it's his war now. There's nobody who can argue that, no matter who gave it to him. It's his war. It is not going well. And frankly, he's facing tougher opposition, given the Republicans' win in November. Here at home, it's hard to be a defeated war president and have any chance of having a domestic agenda go forward.
Daniel Garay at the Lexington Institute, we're out of time, but I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Ahmed Rashid in Lahore, Pakistan, author of Descent into Chaos. Ahmed, you're always great. Thank you very much for being with us today. Listeners, when we come back, we'll hear from Pulitzer Prize-winning now peace activist Chris Hedges. He says, it's time to go. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Peace!
A week ago, protesters led by a group called Veterans for Peace demonstrated there peacefully in front of the White House to protest their country's war in Afghanistan and its semi-war in Iraq. 131 of them were arrested, among them Daniel Ellsberg, and peace activist and former New York Times correspondent Chris Hedges arrested as well. He shared a Pulitzer Prize for reporting on terrorism. Now he's pushing for peace. Before his arrest, right in front of the White House with that big group last week, Hedges gave an impassioned speech before the White House gate fences and quoted W.H. Auden. Here's an excerpt from that speech outside in front of the White House.
If we resist,
and carry out acts, no matter how small, of open defiance, hope will not be extinguished. If all we accomplish today is to assure a grieving mother in Baghdad or Afghanistan, a young man or woman crippled physically and emotionally by the hammer blows of war, that he or she is not alone, our act will be successful. But hope cannot be sustained if it cannot be seen. Any act of rebellion, any physical defiance of those who make war, of those who perpetuate corporate greed and are responsible for state crimes, anything that seeks to draw the good to the good, nourishes our souls, and holds out the possibility that we can touch and transform the souls of others. Hope affirms that which we must affirm. And every act that imparts hope is a victory in itself. Defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies. Yet dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out. Wherever the just exchange their messages, may I, composed like them of eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame. Thank you.
Pulitzer Prize winner Chris Hedges, now peace activist, there in front of the White House last week, quoting W.H. Auden at the end and speaking out for peace. Chris Hedges joins us now from Princeton, New Jersey. His latest book is Death of the Liberal Class. Chris, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
Who was there last week? What'd you say? What happened?
About 500 people, large, about two-thirds of them veterans, either Iraq veterans, Afghan veterans, or Vietnam veterans. And after a rally in the snowfall, there was a harmonica rendition of Taps. There was a folding of a flag that had been on the coffin of one of our soldiers who had come home from the Middle East. And then we walked silently in single file to the White House fence, where eventually we were arrested.
And what exactly was your message as you were had it on the megaphone or in the chants there to the White House? What were you trying to say to, I guess, President Obama?
Well, I wasn't speaking to Obama. I was speaking to the people in Lafayette Park, and the message was that we can't rely on the formal mechanisms of power anymore to respond to the kind of corporate assault that has taken place in the United States, and I would put those wars very high at the list. The war in Afghanistan, and I caught a little of your mm-hmm. previous guests, mm-hmm. and I think they spelled it out, is going terribly. Even people who support the war would concede that. We're losing the war in essence. We've replicated the pattern of occupation that had been put in place for the 10 years of the Red Army, i.e. we control sort of the urban areas where about 20% of Afghans live, and the rest of the country is either in the hands of the Taliban or in dispute. Of course, the war is leaching over the border into Pakistan. And the bottom line is we can't afford it. Unfortunately, we have privatized so much of war making that there are powerful corporations, Halliburton, Blackwater, now renamed Z, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and the list sort of goes on, for whom war is a very, very good business. And if you doubt me, you can look and see how their stocks have quadrupled since the war in Iraq began. And they don't really care what happens to Afghanis. They don't care what happens to Pakistanis. They don't care what happens in the end to our own. They care about profits. And unfortunately, there are very few impediments left within our democratic state to impede the interests of these corporate entities. And you look at a firm like Halliburton, which is parasitic. It makes its money off of taxpayer dollars. They've set up almost all their subsidiaries in Dubai so that they don't even pay taxes on the money, the marrow they suck out of, the American body politic. And this is disastrous. The country is being hollowed out from the inside. We're trying to pay for these wars through loans, $2 billion a day to the Chinese. And I think that the Democratic Party, although they retook Congress in 2006 on the issue of the Iraq War, have proven utterly unable to stand up to these corporate forces. And either we go out into the street or we barrel towards a kind of widespread systems collapse.
Chris, I want to go to that. Let me put in front of you the range of reactions that we're getting in this hour. I mean, you may have heard at least one caller, we couldn't get them all on, but one saying, you know, in Afghanistan, Pakistan, you if you want to be successful, you've got to take the war to the terrorists. Here's some other response online, sort of resonating more with your view, I guess. Jim in Kirby, Vermont, saying, no, no, go for Iran. That's where we'll have some real jobs for Halliburton. Didn't anyone listen to Eisenhower? Jim writes. And Phil says, I guess thinking of President Obama, he writes, Socrates, Jesus, Gandhi, and Martin Luther King would be so very proud. President Obama, who knows, maybe he was looking out at your protest last week. What do you think he's thinking? And are you saying that he's corrupted by the interests of Halliburton?
Without question. He, you know, raised $600 million. Most of that came from corporations. He has served corporate interest assiduously in the last 2 years in the White House, at the expense of working men and women in this country.
But there are a lot of kinds of corporations. I doubt he got too much from Halliburton in his campaign.
Well, you look at the way the rules have changed now because of Citizens United, but it was all bundling. I think his largest bundler was Goldman Sachs, Archer Midland Daniels, and he has done nothing to significantly alter the looting of the U.S. Treasury on the part of Wall Street banks and speculators, speculative firms such as Goldman Sachs that was put in place by the Bush administration. They refused to step in to halt this disastrous foreclosure and bank repossession.
But do you really think, I'm just really curious if you really believe that President Obama cares more about Goldman Sachs' bottom line than about peace and getting out of some of these wars?
I can't, I've never met him. I can't speak about his motives. I can only speak about his actions. And right on down the line, he has reneged on campaign promise after campaign promise to further corporate malfeasance and abuse.
Let's hear from our listeners. Nate in Arlington, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Chris Hedges.
Yes, I'm on the board of directors of Veterans for Peace, and I was proud to be arrested with Chris and 129 other people last week. You know, we've got an empire, a U.S. empire here, and we're spending at least $1 trillion on it every year. And meanwhile, people are out of work. You know, a lot of people don't have health care, education. Everything is being cut except for the military. That's never on the table. And as they talk about deficits, et cetera, the military is never spoken of, yet it's a huge component. We need to dismantle this empire. I applaud Chris and what he writes and what he says. And we need to end these endless wars. I call it the military-industrial finance complex now.
So, Nate, you were there last week in front of the White House. Were you arrested?
I was arrested.
131 or so arrested. General Ellsberg for his 80th time, if I read right, over many years. But this is the biggest protest in a long time in front of the White House. And yet, you know, a lot of the country's not protesting there. Do you feel lonely in this?
I don't feel lonely. I feel like I was with, you know, people of like-minded people, and I feel like we need more resistance and bigger resistance. And this was not covered by the corporate media. They ignored it. The Washington Post had a picture, no article. The New York Times had nothing. So we get this word out on the internet. We get it out on alternative sources, and your program, and we're going to build bigger and bigger resistance actions. We have to go beyond just demonstrations to resistance.
Nate, I appreciate your call. The full video of Chris Hedges' speech, by the way, is at our website, onpointradio.org. Peggy in Mount Vernon, Kentucky. You're on the air, Peggy.
Hello. I have been listening, and I agreed with Elizabeth that we have, if not initiated terrorism against us, we have certainly spurred it on. I agree with Chris Hedges on pretty much everything except that Obama, you know, blah, blah, blah. Not going to do that. But the one thing I want to say is we have not stopped terrorism with our invasions of this and that and the other. And I wanted to bring up it's a maxim we all know. The definition of insanity is to continue to do the same thing we've always done and expect different results. Go for it. This is a great program, and you're doing great.
But Peggy, the White House says, Peggy, they've stopped a lot of attacks with you know, all kinds of security efforts. You don't believe it? You don't buy it?
Well, there's something about putting something in your yard to keep elephants off, and I haven't done that, but if I did, I would expect it to work on elephants up in my holler in eastern Kentucky.
Peggy, you give us something to think about, chew on there. Thank you. John in Des Moines, Iowa. You're on the air, John.
Hi, Tom. I say cut and run, because eventually that's what's going to happen anyway, is cut and run, and we might as well save our blood and treasure at this point. You know, I am really disappointed in the younger generation on the campuses. You know, there is no draft, and during Vietnam, which I served in Vietnam, there was, you know, it was to their own self-interest to protest the war and avoid the draft.
Yep.
Because it was staring them in the face.
Sure.
And now they just seem complacent with the current situation. Shame, shame, shame on young people for not seeing the errors of our ways.
Stand up and get out, you say, I guess, John. Thank you. One more. Christian in West Hartford, Connecticut. We'll come back to Chris Hedges. But Christian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
I just had two quick points to make. The first was, it's not really a choice between war and peace like it was in Vietnam. The difference between now and Vietnam is that peace isn't really an option. In Vietnam, we could have just gone home and let them fight amongst themselves. But now they've made it an active point to try to come at us, which I don't remember them ever doing in Vietnam. And my second quick point is that Chris said we only have about 20% of the country under control. But I'd rather have 20% of it under control than 0% of it under control.
Christian, I got it, and I'll get one more on that theme. Ronald in Rocky Hill. Ronald, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'd like to comment about what I hear, and I understand that everybody worldwide would bring in the peace process if it was at all possible. But I think as the United States as a superpower and being the police of the world, I think we lost our credibility many, many years ago. I mean, it's kind of a sad day when there is a conflict and we give 2 months notice that we're coming and what's going to happen versus when the United States, God forbid, but when we are attacked, I'm sure we are not going to get any notice. I think our credibility as a superpower is slowly going down the tubes. And I think our country is becoming a joke because of it to the other countries, to the foreign countries. Even China's moving ahead.
So what are you saying, Ronald? Stand tough, hang in the war, keep fighting?
I'm not saying that that's the answer to anything, but I think we do need to stand tough. You do have to stand your ground. You cannot just be pushed aside and laughed at as a superpower.
Ronald, we got it. Thanks for your call. Chris Hedges, you heard the call from Christian, who says peace isn't an option. They came after us and they would again. What do you say to that, Chris?
Well, we confuse the so-called war on terror with conventional war. I was in the Middle East covering Al-Qaeda immediately after 9/11. And the only way to fight terrorism, which has been with us since Sallust wrote about it in the Jukarthan Wars, is to isolate terrorists and terrorist groups within their own societies. And after the attacks of 9/11, we had gone a long way towards doing that. I spent 7 years in the Middle East. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times.
Yep.
And Muslims were appalled at what had been done in their name. The major religious authorities, including Sheikh Tantawi, the head of Al-Azhar, the most important Sunni religious institution in the Middle East, immediately denounced the attacks of 9/11 as a crime against humanity, which they were, and then went on to denounce Osama bin Laden as a fraud, someone who had no theological training, no theological legitimacy, no right to issue fatwas or religious edicts. And if we had built on that empathy and realized that this was an intelligence war, not a conventional war, we would be far safer and more secure today than we are. Instead, we responded just as Al-Qaeda wanted. We started dropping iron fragmentation bombs and drone attacks all over the Middle East. We inflamed the entire region. The war is not only leaching outwards towards Pakistan, remember, but also Yemen. It has proved a potent recruiting tool for Al-Qaeda, which has moved out of Afghanistan. Even U.S. intelligence estimates put the number of Al-Qaeda operatives at less than 100. These are supranational organizations. They work out of failed states like lawless areas of Pakistan, Somalia.
Chris, let me ask you, because we've just got a minute left here. What's your, I mean, we're almost at Christmas. You're calling for peace. I don't know. What's your prayer now? What's your big call to fellow citizens from where you stand?
That these wars are deeply counterproductive, not only for those who we wage them against, but ultimately for ourselves, and that we do face the possibility of catastrophic collapse, especially in Afghanistan, and it's incumbent upon us to halt the engines, which are primarily corporate profit-making engines that push these wars forward, and we can't trust in our elected officials, including the Democratic Party, to do it. It's incumbent upon us to get out and protest and make our voices heard. And let's not forget that over 60% of Americans do not support this war in Afghanistan. It does not have popular support.
Chris Hedges. Chris, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Stay warm. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, former correspondent for The New York Times, author most recently of Death of the Liberal Class, and now a peace activist. Listeners, you can join the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gale Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Marika Spence, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.